I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This one is with Jackson Lears about his provocative book titled Rebirth of a Nation, about American mindsets today and how they came to be. His starting question is why Americans keep talking themselves into faraway wars of choice, to wit, Vietnam, Iraq, and now Afghanistan, knowing the horrific price in blood and treasure and reputation. Jackson Lears' answer goes back more than a century to an American longing for regeneration after the Civil War. It's a longing to start over, maybe to be born again, one by one and as a nation. A longing to exercise a manly, muscular Christianity with an unstated thought that maybe war makes us stronger, no matter the evidence to the contrary. Teddy Roosevelt was the embodiment of that urge a century ago. George W. Bush was his lineal descendant, Jackson Lears says. But that is just the start of many links between then and now. Jackson Lears, delighted to meet you on the radio. Introduce the idea of regeneration, and then the echoes that you heard of it in recent years.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Chris. And really, I think the longing for regeneration is rooted in the Protestant tradition, deeply in the Protestant tradition, of desire for rebirth, for becoming a new man or a new woman through conversion. And what happens during and after the Civil War in the United States is that this longing gets translated into secular and ultimately political projects. Everything from bodybuilding and psychotherapy at the personal level to, at the political level, social Christianity, what was called the social gospel, the desire to create a kingdom of God on earth, to tame the excesses of capitalism by promoting a cooperative commonwealth. This is the most benign expression of the longing for regeneration, the most benign public expression of it at any rate. But as you point out, the other, and in many ways the more powerful and enduring aspect of it, is the longing for regeneration through military adventure. And this is coming out of the Civil War, which is interpreted and justified ultimately as a great war of moral regeneration and a great opportunity ultimately to bring the nation together. And the way this happens in the post-Civil War era is that the meaning of the war for the slaves tends to take a marginal or a backseat kind of position to the meaning of the war for the white North and the white South. It becomes an exercise in martial valor and in memory and in the kinds of official recollections of it. And the meaning of it for the slaves gets shunted aside. And there are a lot of people coming of age in the period after the war who, especially if they're male, find themselves swept up in longings to experience the same kinds of heroic struggle that their fathers did, or that they imagine their fathers did, or their uncles, or the previous generation. And Theodore Roosevelt, of course, is the poster boy for this movement. He is a young man who is sickly, asthmatic, nearsighted, and he's told by a doctor at an early age that if he wants to be a real man, he's going to have to make his body, and he vows to do that. And this leads to a familiar process, personal regeneration. It becomes something that Roosevelt manages to dramatize into a movement, not just for himself, but for his class and ultimately for the nation at large. And that is the effort to become manly through heroic struggle, and preferably through heroic struggle on the battlefield. So there's a direct line from that visit to the doctor when he's 12 years old and his charge up San Juan Hill.
And even he's before also, that, he became a boxer at Harvard, right?
Absolutely. No, this is, and then, of course, a cowpuncher out west for a while, too. He looked to the frontier, as a lot of elite men did at this time, as an arena for struggle and regeneration. So Roosevelt creates an agenda that he calls the strenuous life, and this strenuosity is meant to take place in the battlefield, certainly, and in the moral arena. He conflates the two, and he has a tendency to confuse physical courage and moral courage and individual struggle with national struggle. So we tend to get the whole sort of discourse of empire coming out of these private needs. And I talk about Roosevelt at such length because he's such an influential figure, but his struggles are those really of an entire class, and you could almost argue an entire gender. Certainly it's very much a male project and an upper class male project in this period, with the huge consequences, because of course we're coming out of a long tradition of distrust of empire. We created the United States of America in an anti-imperial struggle with the British Empire, and we're looking for ways always to deconcentrate power. We're distrustful of concentrated power. We're distrustful of standing armies. All of these things are deeply anti-imperial. The whole notion of a republic is created in opposition to empire. And yet for Roosevelt and the rest, it is not so much a betrayal of the republic as a fulfillment of it and an opportunity to carry it abroad. But, of course, this is not an uncontested struggle, this effort to turn a republic into an empire.
Jackson, as you say it so beautifully, and you write it wonderfully, but can I throw in the other side of this piece, at least in my own head? I read your book in many ways against the background of a book I cherish, Louis Menand's Metaphysical Club, which is about exactly the same period after the Civil War, the invention of pragmatism by men who were horrified by what we came to in our own country. Oliver Wendell Holmes left for dead at Antietam, wounded three times badly, comes back and says there's got to be another way. William James is the patron. Ralph Waldo Emerson, in a certain sense, is the grandfather of this whole project to rethink our way back from the extremes of war, the loss of war, etc. In Louis Menand's book about this period, the pragmatists and the anti-imperialists, in effect, win the day. William James is the big hero. You have the same cast of characters, but in a certain sense, Teddy Roosevelt, that rambunctious, slightly over-boisterous, risk-taking, I got to prove myself impulse, is the one that has the sort of viral energy into the 20th century and the 21st. Score this contest, if you can, sort of neutrally, between these two forces coming out of the incredible destruction and shame and ruin and remorse of the Civil War.
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I'm a great admirer of the Menand book as well. I think that I try to give William James equal, if not greater, time with Teddy Roosevelt, along with some of the other anti-imperial voices, because I think they remain quite strong in this period. And I think James in particular creates a tradition that survives in our culture as a counterpoint to military adventurism. And of course, he even writes an essay called A Moral Equivalent of War, as you know. And the argument of that essay is that pacifism by itself is not going to do it. It's a flavorless world. A world without struggle is a world that we don't really want to inhabit. That war, he acknowledges, William James, of course, who sat out the Civil War and
His brothers suffered devastatingly, though. I mean,
that's right.
He was exposed to
two brothers who went and were wounded. Yes, exactly. And he was a best friend of Oliver Wendell Holmes. So he had many friends and family who were involved in the war. He himself did not go, but he, in some ways, realized that he had missed something. He had missed some kind of fundamental and particularly masculine experience at the time. And so he ends up writing The Moral Equivalent of War towards the end of his life, wherein he recognizes the value of war as a promoter of courage and heroic struggle, but at the same time remains a pacifist in the sense that he rejects the violence and the destruction of war as a means to an end. So he's looking for ways to recapture the manly virtues, the warrior virtues, without actually going to war. So he's participating in this movement himself, but in a much more humane fashion, I think. Mm. And his pragmatism, as well as what he calls his radical empiricism, which is a taking of all kinds of experiences seriously, including the experiences of hallucination and despair and the other kinds of extreme psychic struggles that he himself went through as a young man and really throughout his life. I mean, one of his students said that he always seemed like he was stepping out of a sadness to meet someone, even as he celebrated energy and action. So James is a fascinating figure and a fascinating counterpart to Holmes and to Teddy Roosevelt. Now, Holmes, I have to say, I take a slightly different take on him because his speech, A Soldier's Faith, really does celebrate action for its own sake, energy for its own sake. It's almost as though, you can hear the epigraph to Teddy Roosevelt's strenuous life behind Holmes's words, which is a couple of lines from Tennyson's Ulysses, "How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use." It was also Robert Kennedy's favorite poem, but we can talk about that. But this is where I differ from Manand, is that I see this impulse, this desire for heroic struggle and action and energy, almost as ends in themselves, especially male ends, as something that survives and resurfaces in our history.
Well, yeah, I think you'd have to say that the, 10 years since Luc Manand's book have shown that the impulses you're writing about are still hugely powerful. But take stock. And I'm thrilled at the direction of your whole thinking, Jackson Lears. We're talking about empire and republic as these kind of twin themes of American history right from the beginning. It's a theme, strangely enough, that media doesn't like to frame any of our situation today in terms of this choice between, shall we say, the health of the people or even healthcare of the people and our role abroad. But it goes way back to the European settlement of this continent. A city on a hill in a lowercase republican definition or an empire of liberty. And it all comes to a head in this period. As I read your book, though, I was thinking, it almost comes down to a personal argument between one of the great teachers of his time, William James, who we've been talking about. He was the star of the Harvard faculty 100 years ago, and one of his pupils, alongside W.E.B. Du Bois and Gertrude Stein, but Teddy Roosevelt. And I'd love you just linger on that contest. You know it much better than I. But William James was scared, even when Teddy Roosevelt was an undergraduate, by an over-entitlement, over-boisterousness, certain recklessness, and as soon as Teddy Roosevelt got launched in New York politics, William James started writing sort of warnings in letters about where this could go. They were both children of Darwin in a certain way. William James, just as much as Teddy Roosevelt, he knew that we human beings were the product of conflict, tooth and claw, but somehow it had become much too destructive to be indulged. That's why he wanted a moral equivalent. He didn't expect us to become, pussycats overnight, but he felt it had to be put in other channels. And yet Roosevelt, as you say, is still the kind of the headwaters of this impulse toward war.
Well, that's right. And Roosevelt comes to Harvard during his presidency and gives one of the class day orations. And James, who has been trying to keep an open mind about this guy during his presidency, because after all, Roosevelt does attempt to tame corporations during this period in various fitful ways, and does have a sense of noblesse oblige, in some ways the same mentality that promotes his vision of the heroic warrior and the chivalric ideal, the sort of aristocratic or pseudo-aristocratic mentality, also promotes his distrust of mere money and plutocracy, and leads him to be willing to confront, however fitfully and briefly, figures like J.P. Morgan and James J. Hill and the other robber barons of the time. But T.R. comes to Harvard, and I think it's 1905, sometime in the middle of his presidency, and he gives a speech that's basically denouncing the life of the mind, and he tells these young men at Harvard to go out and be actors, not thinkers. And of course, William James is a thinker. He is a man of thought as well as action, and he's very distrustful of this kind of very overt and aggressive anti-intellectualism. And I think that's a fair assessment of Teddy Roosevelt, in spite of the fact that the man read voraciously and produced thousands of pages of books. He was fundamentally anti-intellectual, and he was not willing to probe the consequences of his ideas. And of course, for that, that was the whole ball game for William James. The way to evaluate an idea was to try to assess its consequences in your personal life, in public life, and the rest. This is the essence of pragmatism. And Roosevelt was, in that sense, not a pragmatist. He was a heedless and reckless activist and a believer in force for its own sake. I mean, there's even something somewhat proto-fascist about these sentiments that Roosevelt feels toward war, and he really runs off the rails after he leaves the presidency, before the American entry into World War I, when he's out on the hustings demanding American entry and denouncing Wilson for his timidity and not pushing the United States into war more vigorously. And Roosevelt really believes that war itself has a value and a regenerative quality and impact that nothing else can supply. So in that, he's different from both James, profoundly different, as well as from Woodrow Wilson.
Where was it that Teddy Roosevelt said we have to preserve the barbarian virtues?
He actually said that in a letter to it's a very interesting correspondent to a man named G. Stanley Hall, who is a psychologist at Clark University in Worcester, Mass., and the man who actually invited Sigmund Freud to these shores for the first time. He's a leading figure in psychology and the man who invented the concept of adolescence. And Hall was very receptive to Roosevelt's idea, which was that stoicism, physical courage, endurance, all honorable values, but all values that could be placed in the service of empire, needed to be revived in our young people, and especially our young men, and even more especially our young men of what Roosevelt and Hall, too, like to call the leadership class. So this was the context of that, and it was written in 1899. It was after the adventure in the Caribbean, but while the Philippine War was still going on.
The Philippine War, which inspired William James to write exactly the opposite. We have to curb. We are products of barbarian virtues in a way, but we have to curb the results before we destroy ourselves. When did you start hearing echoes of all of this argument in the Bush administration, in the Iraq War context?
Well, I think we heard it I think we heard murmurings, actually, even before Bush came to power, among the people who call themselves the Vulcans, Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and a few of the others who were already spoiling for a fight after the first Gulf War, when they believed that the first Mr. Bush hadn't finished the job, and that we had better get back to work on that front. So there were murmurings of it, and I think it, of course, becomes unleashed and open after 9/11 when talk about empire becomes much more open and unashamed. I think there's a almost a celebration of the U.S. as not only the indispensable nation, as Madeleine Albright called it, but the great new empire, the successor to the British Empire in particular. And so a figure like Neil Ferguson comes along and basically lectures us on our imperial responsibilities and urges us to pick up the white man's burden that the Brits have so unceremoniously dropped. And so it's about the time all of these things are converging in the late 90s and then certainly coming to a head after 9/11 when we have a whole new rationale, a defensive rationale for what are basically offensive, preemptive or preventive wars, so-called. So there's a tremendous ferment, and also I think Robert Kagan is another one. Mm-hmm. There are a whole set of policy intellectuals who come to the fore and provide a great deal of legitimacy for the idea of empire in the sense that it's in the U.S. tradition, they want to claim, and it's in the, and it is certainly our primary global responsibility at the moment. And they're quite indifferent and I would argue ignorant of the anti-imperial tradition, which is still powerful in this country, but not as powerful as it once was, and is certainly rooted in the ideas of the founding fathers.
Fascinating. I mean, the chattering classes were suddenly full of empire talk, and the neocons en masse, but also other people that sort of surprised you. The Christopher Hitchens, for example, big rooter for the war. But I think of Andrew Sullivan. I think of other war bloggers. How did that happen? Even among people who would have called themselves, you know, liberals, people aware of our history, how do you account for that blossoming of kind of imperial cheerleaders?
Well, I have to tell you that was part of the context for my conceiving this book. This is a book that I wrote out of sadness and anger originally at the state of our public life and particularly our public discourse. And a lot of the sadness and anger came from my perception of and observation of the behavior of so-called centrists, moderates, even liberals. Some of the people you mentioned, Peter Beinart is another one, George Packer, and others. Now, they didn't have the field all to themselves, but nearly so. And I think it's important to remember that there were major figures, including the sadly recently deceased Ted Kennedy, who called his vote against the Iraq War the proudest vote he ever cast in the Senate. Paul Krugman, they're major figures who spoke out against the war and were right about it all along. And as Krugman pointed out not too long ago on his blog, the people who were right about the war all along are still viewed as ideologues who are not really to be trusted, whereas the people who were wrong about the war, whether it's Hitchens or Packer, Beinart or the rest, Tom Friedman, any number of other people who like to consider themselves centrists or liberals or moderates, these people are viewed as somehow more serious and more worth
taking. They're still in their chairs.
That's right.
Being wrong on the war was a good career move for so many people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that another part of the answer to your question is that the reason that there was not as much legitimate and mainstream opposition to the war as we might have hoped, and that so many people in the center caved, is that it was a post 9/11 world, as well as a post Vietnam War, where the right had really gotten the upper hand and had rewritten recent history in a way that made anything less than overt support for American military action abroad, somehow a betrayal of our troops. The whole line of supporting our troops was invoked quite cynically and maliciously in that connection. And so there's a dramatic difference between 100 years ago and today in that the anti-imperialists of that time, 100 years ago, which included people like Andrew Carnegie and William Jennings Bryan, as well as William James and Mark Twain, they were much closer to the lowercase Republican tradition. And we, on the other hand, have lived through a half century or more of interventionist foreign policy abroad is just simply the default setting. You know, this is what America does. We do, in fact, go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, which is what John Quincy Adams warned against and declared the United States did not do.
What I noticed both in Peter Beinart and George Packer especially was that they wrote about policy again, with this confusion of the personal and the public, we've got to be men here. The country's got to be manly. I mean, here the most heavily armed republic in the history of the planet, of the cosmos, has got to be tough, they kept saying. There was a kind of personal, defensive, endangered edge in what they were writing. The Democrats have got to prove that they can be as right. tough as others. How do we account for that?
Well, I do think it's partly partisan politics, as you suggest. The Democrats are always on the defensive and always having to prove their toughness. But I also think coming out of the 90s prosperity, there's a real feeling, and this is, again, resonant with Teddy Roosevelt, the turn of the century. I mean, he counterposed the strenuous life to what he called the life of ignoble ease, which is the life of softness and comfort and prosperity that presumably was the only alternative and the debilitating alternative, morally and physically debilitating alternative to war. Mm. So when you read these almost ecstatic assertions in the wake of 9/11 about the opportunities for moral regeneration that we had now and this heroic struggle against global terrorism, a historian like myself thinks immediately of Roosevelt and Brooks Adams and Alfred Thayer Mahan and Henry Cabot Lodge,
right.
Albert Beveridge, the whole crew from 100 years ago, because they were saying the same things. War is a good thing. War is a way to lance the boil of luxury and drain all of that corruption out of the body politic. And, of course, they weren't using exactly that kind of Victorian language in the period after 9/11. But it's often strikingly resonant of that. It's the sense that at last we have a higher public purpose, as if war is the only time we can commit ourselves to the commonweal and to some larger good than just private self-seeking. There's something really disturbing to me about that. And I think what the real task at hand is how to shift this longing for regeneration, which I don't think is going to go away, even though we're not a Protestant country anymore and it doesn't have all the old theological baggage. The yearning is still there. It's very American. It's very much about the possibility of reinventing the self and reinventing the nation. And yet we have to figure out more constructive ways to adapt that language of rebirth to benign purposes, as I think Jane Addams and many of her contemporaries at the time did. Robert La Follette and other
right.
progressive senators who were quite skeptical about military involvement abroad nevertheless felt that they wanted to create a cooperative commonwealth. They wanted to tame the worst excesses of capitalism and salve the abrasions of it. And that's how we got the beginnings of a welfare state. So the dream of rebirth can be taken in various directions. And this is why Obama's so interesting.
Jackson, there's one more question before we get to the Obama age about the anti-imperial faction then and now. I think, like you, I was fascinated and kind of appalled by the silence of the anti-imperial wisdom in the Bush period. I mean, it had, as you said, been Mark Twain, big shots. I mean, he was the voice of America in 1900, and he was militant against the adventure in the Philippines, and as well as Carnegie and other very, very big deals. In the Bush era, I mean, not one major newspaper or publication opposed the war in Iraq. The anti-imperial, you know, mantle fell to people like, say, Gore Vidal or Ron Paul in the presidential campaign, or John Stewart, to give him big-time credit.
But right. our Mark Twain, yeah.
Yeah, where were the big guns of our culture, including the post-imperial voices in the Caribbean, in Europe, in Africa, in India? Where were they in this fight against the Bush folly?
Well, as I say, I think it was very much a product of the zeitgeist that arose in the wake of 9/11. The eagerness that so many intellectuals and pundits seemed to feel to believe the justifications for the war when is simply astonishing, I think. In retrospect, it was astonishing to me at the time. When Colin Powell went to the UN, for example, and put together this cobbled-together argument for intervention, and the laughably unconvincing claim that Saddam Hussein was still moving weapons of mass destruction around on mobile launchers. And, of course, we already had a phalanx of UN inspectors on the ground at work who were finding nothing and who were not allowed to finish their work. So there was something almost akin to mass hysteria that overtook not so much the population at large, although there was assent there, but a good part of the punditocracy. And I think it was a very sad moment in the history of the Republic. And yet at the same time, I think the post-9/11 atmosphere almost guaranteed it. There were the occasional voices. I think Andrew Bacevich is another good example of a man who put in his time and paid his dues, a career military man, West Point graduate, now a political scientist at Boston University. Who has lost a son in the Iraq War.
Yeah.
He was against it from the beginning and was, in fact, a major critic of American militarism, which he distinguishes quite rightly from military service. It's a destructive ideology, and it's an ideology that's often based in fantasy about the regenerative effects of violence and military struggle. And it often takes professional military people to debunk it.
Jackson Lears, let's talk about present time today, the age of Obama. There was more than a touch of regeneration in the Obama campaign. He put a stamp of rebirth on the ticket, and a lot of us voted for it. Now what?
Now what, indeed? I think I felt the same way, that this was a real opportunity. And like a lot of other people, I was moved profoundly by the victory of Obama and moved to tears, in fact, and about the sense of possibility that this seemed to restore, as well as I kept thinking of the term deliverance. I think that, you know, I thought of this as a deliverance from a kind of nightmarish period in our history. And a period when really there had been a kind of unfolding coup d'etat going on, running roughshod over civil liberties and certainly the Republican tradition. And Obama seemed to promise, and certainly in his campaign rhetoric, a fundamental departure from the kind of imperial abuses that Bush and company had specialized in and had basically deployed so effectively and relentlessly while they were in power. he seemed to promise deliverance. That was the word that came to mind to me, and regeneration, of course, along with that.
Jackson, is you're putting a lot of those Obama hopes in the past tense.
Well, I'm afraid that I'm watching him fritter away a tremendous opportunity here. And of course, part of Obama always was the community organizer, the conflict resolver, the pragmatic politician. No one could get where he had gotten without being all of those things and without doing all of those things very well. And yet at the same time, certainly his campaign rhetoric with respect to civil liberties, with respect to education, with respect to health care, all of that was tremendously promising without, in my view, being overly optimistic. It was hopeful in the best sense of that word, which is a somewhat chastened optimism. And yet, soon after his election, it became apparent that he was picking a very familiar cast of characters, both to conduct his foreign policy and to conduct his economic policy, some of whom had created the mess or helped to create the mess we were in on both fronts already. So that was discouraging. And then, of course, the way the health care so-called debate has fallen apart. And I think there's been a lack of leadership. I hate to say it, but I don't see the kind of leadership that Obama had a mandate to provide. And I think he could have made more things happen, certainly with respect to health care, more effectively, and could have taken command of the debate and framed it more effectively rather than bending over backwards to create this sort of bipartisan consensus that I think is an utter delusion when you're dealing with the kind of rabid free market ideologues that are left on the Republican side now that all the moderates have been defeated by Democrats. And I'm very dispirited by this. I haven't given up hope altogether because I do think that Obama represents in some ways the soft imperial side of the American imperial tradition rather than the hard Teddy Roosevelt side. He's a representative of the Woodrow Wilson side. That's a side that at least sees war as a last resort, we hope, rather than as something that's actually desirable. It's less bellicose in rhetoric, and it can be persuaded, people of that persuasion can be persuaded to sit down and talk about things in ways that the more extreme militarists can't. Nevertheless, in its very benign quality, the humanitarian interventionist argument can be quite seductive and ultimately quite dangerous as well. And that's what I fear I see happening in Afghanistan at the moment.
I was going to ask you that, but with a racial twist too. How does race work in this moment? Jim Crow and empire went together in your history. I mean, 100 years ago, the racist repression of the former slaves under Reconstruction was the flip side of all that manly imperialist expansion abroad.
Right.
Today, in a changed world and a changed complexion of our own White House, what drives the first black president in foreign adventures? And very specifically in Afghanistan.
Well, I think that the hard part of it for him is that he does inherit this democratic defensiveness about foreign policy, about not being tough enough, and along with a kind of managerial humanitarianism that is very reminiscent of Wilson, and that leads to overreaching. I mean, the agenda in Afghanistan is so broad and so diffuse and involves so many different parties with opposed interests cooperating in various ways that it's hard to imagine how it could ever play out into a successful program of nation building, so-called. And in fact, the very notion that we can come into a foreign country, particularly one whose culture is as remote from ours as Afghanistan's, but really any foreign country, and have the hubris to build a nation there is quite extraordinary to me. So Obama's race has not prevented him from embracing that broad universalist vision, which is a pluralist vision. And of course, it's a benign one in many ways, but The fact is it does lead to catastrophic consequences in many cases. The other side of it is the Cairo speech, which I think was a major step forward, and it is a sign that a dark-skinned man who is heading the United States can inspire hope and trust and at least a sense of possibility. I can remember hearing Palestinians and Egyptians and other major figures from the Arab world expressing what I thought at the time, even back about the time Obama had just been elected, somewhat inflated hopes about what he could actually do in the region. But that's what they wanted. That's what they desired. And I didn't blame them for placing a lot of hope in Obama, because after all, it does make a difference when you have a black man standing up there and representing the United States of America. It does make a difference to the rest of the world, as well as to Americans. And appearances are quite meaningful sometimes. So I don't discount any of that. But on the other hand, I'm concerned that even as he embodies a more multicultural and more pluralistic perspective, and certainly a more diplomatic perspective than a militarist one, the willingness to talk to Iran, for example, again, like the Cairo speech, is a sign of some cause for hope. But I also think the universalist aims, the old Wilsonian tradition, is not dead by any means, and that we can go marching abroad in search of monsters with the best of intentions, and those adventures can go horribly awry. There's a great deal of hubris involved in either case, it seems, whether you're talking the hard line or the softer line.
And then finally, there's the question of the boom and bust cycle in this story then and now. I mean, the Gilded Age of George W. Bush and the rise of the hedge funders, the widening wealth gap, all of that was named after the Gilded Age of the 19th century that Mark Twain wrote about, too. How is the economic crisis of today playing into this whole business of regeneration and imperialism, do you think?
Well, that's a tough question. And I think that certainly at the time, 100 years ago or more, we experienced this horrific depression in the 1890s. And part of the reason we came out of it is that we were able to export goods abroad more successfully. And this led a lot of economists and others to say that, well, empire is really the solution to the problems of so-called overproduction, and that we really just need to search for foreign markets as well as foreign resources and investment opportunities. And this is how we're going to maintain prosperity. And I think that things are a lot more complicated in that respect now. They were always complicated, but it was possible, of course, to send in the Marines and basically run countries like Santo Domingo as U.S. protectorates for decades in the earlier part of the century. And that, of course, what was done. It was also the period when the first banana republic, Honduras, became virtually a satellite of the United Fruit Company. So the relationship between empire and prosperity was fairly straightforward at that time, and was pursued fairly overtly. Now, of course, we have a similar relationship between empire and prosperity, in the sense that empire runs on oil, and we all know where a good deal of the world's oil is located, in the Middle East. And this, of course, underlies a great deal of the humanitarian rhetoric, whether it comes from the Bush administration or the Obama administration. These are what oil is, after all, at the center of what Joe Biden once euphemistically called our core interests in the region. So the material underpinnings of empire are still very much with us, and the dream that we can somehow smooth out the rough spots in the business cycle by expanding U.S. economic affairs abroad dies very hard, and I think we're looking at a period when it's very difficult to have the kind of debate we had 100 years ago, partly because we don't have the same sense of public responsibility among the wealthy. You look at a figure like J.P. Morgan. He, for all of his faults, he was in many ways a very ordinary ruling class banker, and yet at the same time he had a sense of public responsibility. He had a sense that that his wealth could be used and indeed ought to be used to stabilize the economy and to allocate the money supply in ways that would assure prosperity and in ways that fit his version of the public good. In some ways, he was a one-man Federal Reserve Board before there was a Federal Reserve. So, he had a sense of public responsibility. Other rich people at the time did. And the broad middle and upper class, professional classes, had that sense that capitalism had really been running out of control for a while, and the ravages of the Great Depression of the 90s demonstrated this. So as we came out of that depression, we really did have a progressive movement to regulate capitalism and create the beginnings of a welfare state. Now we're in a situation where we've had 30 years of uneven but real prosperity for at least the more fortunate members of our society. And we've also have a period of almost complete domination of public discourse by free market mythology. And the problem then is how you undo yourself, how you unstick yourself from that mythology, even when it's been demonstrated clearly that it hasn't worked.
You leave a huge question hanging there, and we'll have to come back to it. But it seems to me, first of all, you've given us a hugely valuable history in this book, Rebirth of a Nation, and a hugely valuable conversation. And yet still, I mean, we need, above all, history, history, history. And we still need some way to fire up in the chattering classes some of the lessons of realism and restraint. Who's to do that?
Well, I'm ready to sign up.
Well, we'll sign you up.
I do think this is what we have to do, and there are people who are out there trying to do it. Obviously, you're trying to do it in your own way, and Paul Krugman and Andrew Bacevich and others. It's not about ideological conformity.
It's a nice group.
It's not about hewing to a particular liberal line. It is really about, and this gets back to my hero William James
and mine.
It's about the what he called radical imperialism. It's taking all kinds of experience seriously and injecting our public discourse with that awareness of human experience. And one of the things that happened back at the turn of the century is that people were willing to do that, the populists and the progressives. They were willing to talk, and they were well-informed about economic matters and sophisticated enough to see that the money supply was not something sacrosanct and stable, but in fact could be manipulated to promote the public good. And they were also willing to be outraged about economic injustice.
I love it. I'm ready to sign up for the party of William James, the slogan of radical empiricism, which also means measure the results of things and then hold
Absolutely.
People accountable.
Exactly. Accountability is key.
Jackson, it's a great pleasure. We're going to do it again. Thank you for your book. Thank you for your work. The book is Rebirth of a Nation, The Making of Modern America, 1877 to 1920. Jackson Lears is the Board of Governors Professor of History at Rutgers University in New Jersey. We are in your debt, Professor Lears. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation with Jackson Lears. Our Brown interns, Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern, were in on the whole exercise in cultural history. Post your own lessons and notes on the byplay of republic and empire as maybe inseparable strands of the American story at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.